current state on 90.5 WKAR, a Wednesday edition. I'm Mark Bayshore. A reminder, we will be coming to you live Friday evening from the Great Lakes Folk Festival in downtown East Lansing. If you're going to be taking in the acts and the exhibits and the presentations, be looking for us. We'll be looking for you. Later on this hour, Bill Ballinger and Kyle Malin and I will all review last night's primary, midterm primary election results. We'll update the Ebola situation, and we speak with Go Green Trikes' Yvonne LaFave and talk about her first few months of business as a green-oriented, it's all electric vehicles at Go Green Trikes for Yvonne LaFave in downtown Lansing. Yvonne visits with our Peter Wharf coming up. Marriage equality supporters in Michigan are closely watching events unfold today in Cincinnati. That's where the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals will hear arguments on the state's ban on same-sex marriage. The court may decide the fate of Michigan's ban, as well as those in Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. The Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta has been covering this case, and he joins us now from Cincinnati. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, Mark.
From a legal perspective, remind our listeners what this case is really about.
Well, the Michigan case, like you pointed out, there are actually six cases from four states, and the marquee cases are Michigan and Ohio. And the reason that Michigan is so significant is that this isn't, it doesn't nibble around the edges as to whether or not a state should be required to recognize marriages performed in other states or something like this. This is a square, front and center challenge to the Michigan's marriage amendment, the ban on same-sex marriage and civil unions. Back in March, a judge in Detroit ruled that it violated equal protection and due process rights, and so Attorney General Bill Schuette has brought the case to here to Cincinnati, and you know, it's been combined with other, you know, those other cases from states in this federal appeals court circuit.
Attorney General Bill Schuette says upholding the ban reflects the will of Michigan voters. Is that the core of his argument, or are there other legal precedents that in some ways bolster that view?
Well, the Attorney General and people who are supporting the state's position in this actually took a lot of comfort from the court's the United States Supreme Court's decision in another Michigan case, and that was the one on the affirmative action ban, where the court's opinion said that when voters make a policy choice to pass a law or amend the state constitution, that the courts ought to give that, you know, particular special deference. And they say, so that should be in play here. A lot of what this is going to hinge on is it's a technical legal matter, but it's basically setting the bar and how far the state has to go to defend the marriage amendment. That opponents of the amendment want is for the court to say that the bar is set very high. If you go to the highest bar, it would be something called strict scrutiny. And basically what that means is that the onus falls on the state to defend the law. Otherwise, you know, at lower levels, more intermediate levels, all the state has to prove is that there was a legitimate interest, that there was compelling government interest involved. And whether or not the state, whether or not voters got it right, is less relevant than the state's right to take a policy position on that. So that's where the state is at. And what they're going to say is that the court should give great deference to the voters, and it is the state's right and responsibility to make rules regarding things like what constitutes a marriage. What the opponents of the Michigan Marriage Amendment are here arguing is that, first of all, marriage is a basic right. It is an essential right, and not one that can be put to a vote of the people, not one that could be legislated by state lawmakers, and that, in fact, there is no compelling government interest in banning same-sex marriage, while the ban does, in fact, cause harm, financial, psychological, social, to same-sex couples and the children they may be raising. And remember, that is the crux of the Michigan case, that this was brought by a lesbian couple from Hazel Park who initially just went to court because they wanted to jointly adopt the children that they're raising together.
We're talking with the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta, who is in Cincinnati to cover the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals decision on Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage and possibly rulings involving other states. There has been a wave of legal challenges around the country to these state bans. How much of an impact could a ruling in the Michigan case have on the national momentum toward allowing same-sex marriage?
Well, I mean, there are almost an unbroken string of almost 30 legal victories for proponents of same-sex marriage. And so, you know, people will certainly be watching to see if this falls, within that same pattern, or if the Sixth Circuit decides that maybe the brakes ought to be put to this effort. Certainly, courts, watch each other to see what legal reasoning they're applying to these cases, especially as they go higher up. One possible outcome here is that the Sixth Circuit could say, you know what, we're just going to wait and see what the United States Supreme Court does, because just yesterday the state of Utah asked the Supreme Court to take up a challenge to its ban on same-sex marriage, which was struck down. And so, now that's in play, and that's the first time that particular question has been put to the United States Supreme Court since it ruled last summer that there would be federal recognition of same-sex marriages where they are legally performed.
We got to leave it there. Rick Pluta of the Michigan Public Radio Network, live in Cincinnati, covering the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals decision today on Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage. Thanks very much, Rick.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark.
We turn quickly now to the August midterm election, which is behind us. Here to review some of the results, we go to MERS News' Kyle Malin, who's in our studio. Good morning, Kyle.
Hey, good morning.
And Inside Michigan Politics, Bill Ballinger is on the other end of our line. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Mark.
Let's spend a few minutes on both Proposal 1 and Mid-Michigan results, and we'll open this up. Michigan voters have approved Proposal 1, which establishes a framework for reimbursing governments and municipalities after the gradual elimination of the personal property tax on businesses. Kyle, how are you interpreting this?
Well, it looks like those who were supporting Proposal 1, which is basically the manufacturers, General Motors, Ford, put down at least $8 million to try and get this thing passed, and they were successful. The messaging campaign on this was basically this is going to help business, particularly small business, even though the small businesses are really more the manufacturing small businesses, but whatever. They were more successful in getting out that message, and the local governments were giving them support too, saying that this was going to give them a better funding stream down the line. And so without any real organized opposition, with the exception of folks who just didn't understand this ballot proposal, which was basically everybody, and those who are just generally cynical of government in general, there really wasn't going to be a lot of people voting no. And I think that kind of bears out the results here.
Bill, what did you make of the margin?
I was surprised it was this big. I never thought it would be 70%, which is about what it was. I echo everything that Kyle just said. He explained it perfectly. I think there was some feeling out there, I certainly felt it, that there was so much confusion and misunderstanding by the electorate that people might just throw up their hands and say, I'm voting no on this, or not vote on it at all. And that didn't happen. I mean, they were just overwhelmed, the electorate was, by the one-sided ad campaign, $8 million, by the big manufacturing interest groups, and by, for that matter, as Kyle pointed out, local units of government who you might have thought would have at least been neutral on this, but actually came out and said, okay, we support it too, even though I think they're swallowing hard and hoping for the best as we go down the line.
Let's move to the 8th Congressional District. On the GOP side, Mike Bishop prevails. Eric Schertzing for the Democrats. Kyle, what's your takeaway there?
Well, I thought the most surprising result on here was that of Susan Grettenberger on the Democratic primary side. I think Democrats got to feel really excited that she did so well in Livingston and Oakland County, really wiped out Schertzing in both of those counties. It just so happens, though, that Schertzing is such a brand name in Ingham County after having been elected treasurer three times that he beat Grettenberger 2-1 in this heavily Democratic area and negated Grettenberger's wins in Livingston and Oakland County. So, you know, at the bottom, at the end of it all, Schertzing won 43-38%. But I think the takeaway here is that Grettenberger's got a future if she wants to run for something else. She's definitely got good support, whatever that might be.
She was ahead with 70-some percentage, 70-some percent of the polling places in. She was leading, but Schertzing ultimately prevails. Anything to add to that, Bill?
Not much, except you got to remember a primary in August for either party is a totally different animal from the November general election. And so Eric Schertzing doesn't come out of this contest with a huge head of steam as the Democratic nominee, and his party's in the minority in the 8th Congressional District, so he's got an uphill struggle ahead of him.
Let's move to the 4th, which includes Clinton County and featured a trio of Republicans vying for the chance to get on the ballot. Veteran legislator Dave Camp is retiring, of course. We had State Senator John Molinar of Midland prevailing over the accordion-playing businessman Paul Mitchell. Kyle, what do you think?
Well, I think it shows here that a candidate who has a broad base of support can beat somebody who's got a ton of money. Paul Mitchell saturated the airwaves in this area with $4 million of his own money. I mean, by comparison, David Trott put $3 million into his race in Oakland County. Governor Snyder put $6 million into a gubernatorial primary just 4 years ago. So Paul Mitchell put $4 million of his own money in here into a tiny, you know, a congressional district where the media markets aren't necessarily very expensive. Lansing, Traverse City, Flint, and the Tri-Cities area here. And so what happened here is that once Molinar woke up and the Midland establishment woke up, they realized, oh my gosh, we got to actually do something here. They got Bill Schuette involved. Dave Camp set up a super PAC, if you will, and they went on a full court press to try and save this seat from somebody that nobody knew from Adam. I mean, you could have run a Bob Smith in there, ran the same campaign. You might have gotten the same numbers because nobody knew who Paul Mitchell was. All you knew was based on what you saw on the TV ads, which he played the accordion, he shot a crossbow. Other than that, all you knew were the negative ads that were going back and forth. And then in the end, I think what that showed is that a good ground game will beat aerial support in these types of contests.
So, Bill, will Molinar prevail in November? It's a Republican district, correct?
Yes. I mean, he'll win in November. I think Kyle's got it absolutely right. I'll just say one thing I always found very ironic about this race that not too many people really remarked on. Paul Mitchell was the state Republican finance director, and he raised money for Republicans statewide and in the legislature and for the governor and everybody else, in a sense. And yet, when he got into the race as a candidate, he immediately set out not just spending huge amounts of money, but, as Kyle mentioned, negative attack ads against John Molinar. You would have thought John Molinar was a communist, and yet Paul Mitchell was somebody who, for a year or more before that, had been supporting Molinar and people just like him. So it just shows you the incredible lengths candidates will go to win races. And I really thought it was pretty unseemly, actually, of Paul Mitchell to have taken the tack he did. And in the end, it didn't work. He lost.
We're talking with Kyle Malin of MERS News, Bill Ballinger of Inside Michigan Politics, talking about the results from yesterday's primary. Let's go real local here for a second, Kyle. There were three ballot proposals that rose to the top here in Ingham County. On the county level, two that involved funding for Capital Area District Library and CATA, and in Meridian Township, a parks millage, but on the county level, all of these appear to have passed. Any insights there?
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, we took a look at all the local ballot proposals from a statewide basis, and what we saw was that, by and large, when you had a renewal like you had here with the CATA and the Ingham County Library, they passed overwhelmingly. 99% of all the renewals in this state passed. And when you had a new money ask, like what you had in Meridian Township with the parks millage, those passed at an 80% clip. It seemed like the ones that didn't pass were the ones that were asking for large amounts of money, like the Wayne Risa $80 million ask got shot down. That was the biggest one in the whole state. There was one in Belleville that asked for $17 million for a library. That went down. But if it was a moderate amount, like the parks millage that we're talking about in Meridian Township, it seemed to do okay. I think the exception, though, was in Leslie, where they had something that went down.
Let's break from mid-Michigan results for a minute. Bill Ballinger, aside from the results that we've already talked about, what results outstate have most of your attention here today?
The Tea Party victories in a handful of legislative districts around the state by candidates who are very aggressive and in some cases well-known political figures. I'm talking about Gary Glenn in Midland running for state representative, Todd Corser, Lapeer attorney, who almost knocked off the state Republican chairman 2 years ago, Cindy Gamrat, who is a statewide well-known Tea Party activist for the last 4 years over in West Michigan, Lee Chatfield, way up in the Petoskey, Straits of Mackinac area, who knocked off an incumbent Republican, Frank Foster. These are all people who are going to be coming to Lansing, and they're going to be elected in November, and they're going to be very vocal and very aggressive. Now, the establishment Republicans, more mainstream Republicans, most of the time in most races around the state prevailed. And so people are saying, well, the Tea Party was beaten back and it didn't do that well and they fell short. But I think they really scored some very impressive wins in these districts, and I think this proves they're alive and kicking for some time to come.
In the 3rd District, Libertarian Justin Amash not having really much of a challenge against Brian Ellis. Dave Trott, the lawyer and businessman, prevails in the 11th. Let's return to the state capitol here for just a minute, though. Here in East Lansing, Democrat Curtis Hertel Jr. walks in the Democratic primary for the 23rd Senate District being vacated by Gretchen Whitmer. Kyle, any thoughts there?
Well, just that's not really much of a surprise. I actually thought Curtis Hertel had won that seat probably when Joan Bauer said she wasn't going to run for it back in May of 2013. Curtis Hertel has done an amazing job chasing people out of this race, establishing himself extremely early as the person people were going to rally around to replace term-limited State Senator Gretchen Whitmer. So when the results came out, I would have been shocked if Curtis did any worse than 50%. And, of course, he got 70%. So really no shock there, and he'll represent this district for this four-year term. And assuming he does well, which I have every reason to suspect he will, he'll get reelected, I'm sure, next time around.
Here in East Lansing, we are in the 69th House District. Democratic incumbent Sam Singh will face Republican Frank Lambert. Bill, I'd like to go back and hear more of what you make of this 3rd District contest. Justin Amash, according to MLive, went very intense in his remarks after he acknowledged that he was the victor against his challenger, Brian Ellis, according to MLive, really unloaded on this guy. And Ellis had run a TV ad calling Justin Amash Al-Qaeda's best friend in Congress. He said, "I ran for office to stop people like you." What do you make of here the fallout in the 3rd?
Well, the fallout in the 3rd was, don't shoot at the king unless you kill him. The establishment went after Justin Amash and fell short. And Justin Amash, who, again, is considered a Tea Party / Libertarian Republican, won. Of course, it's a little different scenario than these other state legislative races I just described. They were basically in open seats and challengers to incumbents. Justin Amash is the incumbent himself in this race. And I think, you know, there is that old term, sore winner. So maybe Justin Amash was saying, you tried, but you failed, and up yours. You know, I'm the winner.
We'll point out that turnout was low, as forecast, in the neighborhood of 18% or so unofficially. One other surprise, Southfield Mayor Brenda Lawrence prevails in the House 14th District in the amongst the Democrats down there. That's all we've got time for. Unfortunately, I want to really thank both of our bleary-eyed guests here this morning, Kyle Malin of MERS News and Bill Ballinger of Inside Michigan Politics. Thanks, guys.
Our pleasure.
Thanks, Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. An outbreak of Ebola in Africa has health officials worried. Since February, almost 900 people have died in four West African countries. Two medical workers infected with Ebola have been brought to the United States for treatment amid concerns, warranted or not, that the Ebola could break out in the U.S. To learn more about Ebola and what risks, if any, people in Michigan should concern themselves with, we welcome Dr. Eden Wells, a clinical associate professor of epidemiology and director of the Preventative Medicine Residency at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me.
Let's start with a basic question of what Ebola is and where it comes from. We know it's highly contagious. Tell us more.
Yes. You know, the Ebola virus actually became known to us as humans anyway in the 1970s when outbreaks were occurring in the eastern and central part of Africa. And over the last few decades, this particular virus has caused very small outbreaks that tend to end quite quickly. It is a very aggressive and infectious virus. We think now that this is a virus probably that resides in bats. This is not known for sure, but we're highly suspecting that bats play a very important role in the carriage of this virus and the transmission among animals in Africa. And then at some point, should a human be exposed to an infected bat or other animal, such as a primate, such as an ape or a monkey, then that particular human can quickly spread the virus to others if those others are in direct contact with the patient when they become ill. And I remember this distinctly in the 70s as a young teen hearing about this, because the illness is quite impressive. People may start out feeling rather feverish, not well, but quickly escalate, become very ill in terms of headaches, vomiting, diarrhea, and then many of their organs fail. And a lot of it's associated with bleeding. The whole body's bleeding system gets disrupted. So it's one of the viruses that we call as a viral hemorrhagic fever, because very often, especially near death, there's a lot of bleeding involved. And so you can imagine this is something very impressive for any of us that have ever heard about that.
And for the record, how is it transmitted?
In the direct contact, so in the human population, you really have to be in close contact to the fluids of the infected person. The person may be someone you love who's becoming ill, and any kind of contact with their secretions, such as their blood, their vomit, their stool, if they're having diarrhea, if they're coughing up any infected material, any of that is highly contagious. And so you can see, actually, that many of the people in the healthcare setting are having to cover themselves up absolutely, totally, because even their eyes wear a full, what we call full barrier suit. They look like, you know, spacemen, but that's to avoid getting in contact with these fluids. But that's really the main way of transmission. So often what's happening, especially in Africa, is when people are caring for their loved ones who are sick, get in contact, or when they're preparing, if their loved ones or a patient passes away, they're in contact with even the dead body, which still has the secretions on it, they can be exposed in that way as well.
Dr. Eden Wells is our guest here on Current State. Dr. Wells is a clinical associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. We're talking about the Ebola situation in Africa. There's a lot of medicine and science involved when seeking to contain a disease epidemic. But when something like this happens in another part of the world, there are also strong cultural components to achieving containment. How important mm-hmm. is it to understand the culture of the people who are facing an epidemic like this?
Oh, I think what you have just raised is incredibly important and something that we're really dealing with right now. You know, when this arose in late February and March of this year, this Ebola outbreak occurred in Guinea. And Guinea had never ever, this was in Western Africa, had never experienced the Ebola virus that they knew of anyway and as an outbreak. And this is something that is obviously very scary to people. There are traditional and cultural practices around how folks will care for their loved ones or how they care for them for funeral rites. And so many of the common practices may inadvertently cause the other citizens to become in contact with this and then spread the disease. Further, this spread quickly from Guinea to Sierra Leone and Liberia, because there's a lot of travel between these countries. People get on the motorbikes and bicycles and travel across these borders, at least up until this last week or so, fairly easily. And so when they were becoming sick, maybe they were visiting in another country, they would want to go home. That's what we all want to do. But as they do that, they were going home and spreading the disease and then amongst their families in these different areas. So it's cultural, but it's also social. Really needing to understand not only the practices of what the society may do in Africa when they're ill, but also understand that when we become sick, when we have a loved one become sick, we naturally, socially as humans, want to care for them and touch them. So this has been a real tough battle to try to educate people that that's precisely what we can't be doing with these sick patients. We can't touch them directly. We cannot be in contact with them at all without protection.
A fair amount of the TV coverage has centered on how one plane ride could lead to Ebola arriving in the U.S. That has scared a lot of people. Was this a responsible way, do you feel, for the media to approach this outbreak?
That's another good question. I think, there is a very important role that the media plays in alerting all of us to potential dangers. And I think that is a very good thing. I think that we do need to also understand that, and you mentioned this in the previous question, that we have a very different healthcare and public health system here in the United States as compared to what has been occurring in the Western African countries, who have, by the way, been definitely working very hard to control this since CDC and World Health really started working with them last week. I think disease knows no boundaries, and it is. We have seen the case of a gentleman who flew to Nigeria and then became ill and then passed away, and we are having even cases related to who had been exposed to him. But I think even in Nigeria, they have the knowledge of trying to, contact people, isolate them, and then try to ensure that the disease doesn't spread. And so we're not seeing a large outbreak there. Here in the United States, there is we are even hearing on the news about people who are being tested as they come off planes because they've become ill, or they've arrived in a city and maybe become ill a day or so later. We have a high index of suspicion. We know to look for this. Our local, our state, our federal public health departments, and our hospitals have all received a lot of information, especially in the last week, from Centers for Disease Control and World Health about how to be sure to identify someone who may be at risk, quickly isolate them, meaning not letting anybody go near them, touch them, and then also to even put some people who may be suspected to have been exposed, make sure we kind of put them in a safe place too and make sure that they don't become ill. All of these things we can do here much more efficiently in the United States. I can't say that there won't be a case that shows up here, but there will not be. There's an exceedingly low risk of any type of the outbreaks that we're seeing in Western Africa, where that our kind of public health system doesn't exist.
There are, of course, the two American patients, Nancy Wright-Bohl and Dr. Kent Brantley, who are being treated with a serum known as ZMapp. What do you make of their circumstances, and what do you make of ZMapp?
You know, it's very fascinating. And I don't know much about ZMapp than maybe what we've all have been hearing once the company began discussing this over the weekend about the serum, this antibody, which is essentially made in reaction to Ebola infection in mice. And now they're even talking about how tobacco plants can be used for this. Very fascinating. I think there's a lot to be learned. I don't know. This was administered to both these patients. One received two doses, and it may be involved with them actually having improved symptoms and perhaps helping fight the disease. But there's a lot of information, and I think what's very good about them coming to Emory University and being hospitalized there right next door to the Centers for Disease Control is we're going to be able to learn a lot about how this serum may have worked to benefit their illness. We can also learn a lot about how the virus is affecting these two patients, who hopefully sound like they're doing better than certainly they were in the last week or two. But I don't know much yet. There's a lot more information that needs to come.
Dr. Brantley's case is particularly interesting because besides the experimental doses of ZMapp that he got, he also received a unit of blood from a 14-year-old boy who was an Ebola survivor who had been
right
under his care, and I'm reading that may have that was apparently aimed at giving Brantley antibodies that the boy have made to the virus.
Exactly. So again, that raises the question: is how much of a role did perhaps this unit of blood from a young boy who had survived, and therefore maybe his immune system had generated these strong proteins against the virus that can actually fight the virus? You administer those into Dr. Brantley. How much even did that improve his well-being in comparison to later when he received the serum? And I think it's still unclear to me the timeline of, you know, when he received each of those products and how each of those may or may not have contributed to his subsequent improvement in course. But I think we're going to hear a lot about that in the next few weeks from our Centers for Disease Control and Emory University. As they learn, hopefully we'll get some more information how each of those helped.
Dr. Eden Wells of the University of Michigan School of Public Health, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Many thanks for joining us here on Wednesday. On last April's Earth Day, the Lansing company Go Green Trikes launched its all-electric vehicle local delivery service. Go Green Trikes is the brainchild of Yvonne Lefebvre. She joined us on Current State's Neighbors in Action this past spring to talk about her earth-friendly service. WKAR's Peter Wharf caught up with Yvonne Lefebvre at her Lansing garage on Kalamazoo Street yesterday for a look at some of the vehicles and a quick trip around Lansing's east side.
So what are we looking at here?
This is the ELF. It is a vehicle by Organic Transit. ELF is an acronym for Electric, Lightweight, and Fun.
And this is one of your delivery vehicles. Can you describe it to listeners?
Oh, gee. If you took a beetle and put it on a tricycle frame, that's pretty much what you're looking at. It's kind of an orange egg of a thing that is a little bit beyond description. You have to kind of see it for yourself.
You're right. It's sort of like a beetle, or I was thinking on the way over here today because I'd seen a picture of it before. It's sort of half a smart car,
there
maybe,
you go. Yeah.
Mounted on sort of a bike frame, or really sort of a trike frame in reverse with the two wheels in front, and then you have handlebars and then a basic frame to attach the body to.
Exactly, yeah, you've got it.
Now, describe the power of this. Is this pedal or electric or both?
It's actually both. It has a battery, small battery, under the seat. It will allow it to go 20 miles per hour for up to 20 miles. It also can pedal for when the battery runs out or, you know, to help the battery go further. It also has a solar panel on the top that recharges the electric.
So is this a custom-built vehicle or a semi-custom, or is this basically how it comes out of the factory?
This is how it comes. It's not the starter version of how it comes. The starter one, now if you were to buy it, would be about $5,000. Yep, this is considered the BMW version. It has more gears, a couple more bells and whistles than what the other one would have.
Where's the Elf made?
Durham, North Carolina. Small company called Organic Transit.
Do they make other vehicles?
They're working on a couple other vehicles. One, I think they're calling the Truckit, or they might have changed the name. It's made for commercial deliveries. So we'll see if that one comes to market, but yeah.
So that's the Elf. Mm-hmm. Let's go over to this vehicle. I think this is the one we'll be riding a little bit today.
It is, yeah. This one will allow 600 pounds on the back. Picture a tricycle with a pickup flatbed on the back. And that's kind of what you're looking at. This is the Truck Trike. It is made in Portland, Oregon, Stites Design. And this one is brand new on the market. They've had earlier versions, so this is version 3.2, number one. I got the first one made.
Very good. This is very sturdy and stout looking. I mean, that's a huge frame, maybe like 6 inches thick. And then, like you said, that pickup bed is really the size of maybe a short bed pickup.
It is, yeah. When I get it with a topper, right now it's just a flatbed sort of thing, but with the topper, we're looking at 93 cubic feet of space. So that's pretty much what you're looking at with a pickup truck with a topper.
Right. And the power, this is both pedal and electric as well?
This is pedal and electric as well. A much oomphier sort of battery and whatnot.
So what are we doing right now?
Right now we are setting up a throne for you.
Okay.
The truck trike isn't made for passengers typically, at least not with the flatbed. And I kind of want to make it safe as possible.
So you got kind of a beach chair for me, bungeed to the frame. That looks pretty secure.
Yeah.
I'll sit there.
Yeah, okay, good. You can even do the Queen's Wave.
Well, as we go down Kalamazoo Street. This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Yvonne Lefebvre, the founder and owner of Go Green Trikes here in Lansing, Michigan. We're on the 1700 block of Kalamazoo Street in Lansing. Yvonne, we've had discussions with you before on Current State about Go Green Trikes, so we had sort of an introduction, but we're having a little bit of a tour of your garage and your vehicles today. We'll go on a short ride around. Tell listeners what Go Green Trikes is.
Okay, well, it's a smart local green delivery service using electric assist vehicles. The biggest one we're looking at will hold up to 600 pounds on the back. So yeah, we have a few different vehicles in the fleet. The two that are electric we've already talked about. We also have a Bakfiet, which is a Danish sort of designed vehicle that has a wooden box in the front and three wheels as well. We also have a cargo bike, actually a couple of them, another one's on the way, and some trailers. The largest one is 8 foot long and will hold 600 pounds by itself.
What are some of the jobs you've done or do on your schedule of delivery?
Let's see, the most consistent client I have is the New Citizens Press. Every other week, I deliver bulk newspapers for them, 1,000 of them downtown Lansing, anywhere from 25 to 300 at a drop, and there's probably 18 different drops. So yeah, that one's the most consistent. We also do, gee whiz, pretty much anything. We've done a move of one apartment from like a half a mile away to a new location, all by trikes. That was fun.
Well, you're set up here with this flatbed trike to really move a student's apartment quite
exactly.
quite handily.
Yeah, that's kind of what it's for.
Well, how about a quick ride?
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to climb aboard. Right. Got my camera.
Careful.
Whoa, okay. And now I'm in my cockpit there. Okay. All right. Oh, yeah, I feel very exposed, but secure.
If you can. Truly exposed.
Right. We won't hear anything because it's electric.
Oh, there is a bit of a
There is, okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. So you're going to start by pedaling to get it going.
Yeah, it saves the battery a bit.
Okay. Now we're moving out of the parking lot. Whoa, okay. That was the battery, right?
Yep.
Okay. And the pedaling brings us up to speed. How fast are we going now?
14.4.
14. That's a pretty fast speed on a bike.
Yeah, especially when I'm carrying weight.
Right. You said this goes up to about 600 pounds, is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're safe.
We're safe. All right, here we go. All right, we knew we were going somewhere then. How fast did we get up to?
19.9.
19, okay. Yep. We're by the swap meet now.
You
know where that is? Okay. I'll be waving. Now you're doing some pedaling as we're moving at about top speed, 19 miles an hour. Is that to save battery?
It is, yeah. It gives me something to do.
Okay, get a little exercise while you're at it. Nice. Here we are. Made the circle back onto Kalamazoo and heading back to the garage.
And since we're a bike, we're in the bike lane.
Great. Well, 9:20 in the morning, that's the high point of my day for sure.
Yeah, I kind of liked it too.
Beautiful ride. Thanks for that.
Sure, no problem.
You know, it combines the streetworthiness and speed of a delivery vehicle. I mean, I felt like we were very competent in traffic,
yeah.
But the benefits of pedal and electric power.
Right. I mean, we're taking no hydrocarbons, you know, we're just doing carbohydrates.
So what do you hope in the coming months as we get into the remainder of the summer and the fall for Go Green Trikes?
Well, you know, we're starting to develop some relationships with other businesses, like Move In, Move Out MSU is a new company that's trying to start, and we're trying to develop a relationship with them to help them out. So it would be able to help students,
yeah.
You know. There's a lot of different ways that this could be of use to the community, and we're looking to see what those are.
Yvonne Lefebvre is the founder and owner of Go Green Trikes in Lansing, Michigan. Yvonne, thanks for the description of your company and the beautiful ride this morning.
My pleasure.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
This I like.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, some of the possibilities with this, I mean,
it's Wednesday and time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, when we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature the Michigan College Access Network, which is a statewide organization dedicated to increasing access to higher education for low-income, minority, and first-generation college students in Michigan. Here to tell us more about the Michigan College Access Network, its founder and executive director, Brandy Johnson. Welcome to Current State, Brandy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the genesis of the Michigan College Access Network. You go back 4 years?
Yeah, so Michigan College Access Network was founded in 2010. It was inspired by some work that was done at the state level in the former governor's administration, Jennifer Granholm. I was working in her policy office, and as I looked to improve higher ed policy, I realized that there wasn't any connecting hub or umbrella for a college access movement in Michigan. So with the help of a federal grant as well as some philanthropic dollars, I decided to start such a hub or umbrella called the Michigan College Access Network, and we were founded in August of 2010.
So no connecting hub. Tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that.
Yeah, some people would say that our college access work pre-2010 was program-rich and system-poor. What we had in Michigan throughout the state are really well-intentioned, wonderful college access programs, scholarship programs, campus visit programs, outreach programs, but they weren't ever connected into a cohesive strategy to intentionally move the needle on Michigan's college enrollment rate. Our primary role at MCAN is to help community leaders across sectors unite around a singular goal, helping more of our students pursue post-secondary education and actually pull together a strategic plan to do that, largely using existing resources and assets.
Were you amongst the first people to notice that lack of connectivity there?
I think so. It was one of my responsibilities to apply for a federal grant in Michigan. And when I started to research the landscape, it became abundantly obvious. Not very many people know that Michigan is the only state in the country that doesn't have what's called a SHEO, or a state higher ed executive office. There's actually no state agency that coordinates higher education efforts in Michigan. Every other state has a system or a statewide board of regents or a commission that coordinates that transition space between high school and college. And we don't have that in Michigan, and so in some ways we play that connective role.
What are some of the barriers Michigan youth face?
I think there are four big barriers, and it's our job to make sure that students have resources and assets in each of these four buckets. The first is social capital. Students need to aspire to pursue post-secondary education and see themselves as college material. Second is academic readiness or preparation. Students need to be able to leave high school and immediately enter college, taking college-level coursework and not remedial education. Third, and this is something we really focus on at MCAN, is just the navigating the process. If you're the first in your family to go to college, it's really complicated to navigate these bureaucratic systems of higher ed admissions and financial aid policies, and finding the right match and fit for your career goals. And then lastly, and the most often cited barrier to post-secondary education is certainly affordability, although I would say perceived affordability is just as big of a barrier as real affordability. Low-income students think college costs $1 million, and it's our job to inform them of really lucrative Pell Grants and need-based financial aid that the federal government, the state government, and our institutions offer them.
Brandi Johnson's our guest on Current State's Neighbors in Action. Brandi is the founder and executive director of the Michigan College Access Network. You were the first in your family to go to college. How did you view college when you were in high school?
Yeah, I sort of had mixed feelings whether or not I was college material myself, because I didn't see my parents, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, no one before me had ever tried college. It was sort of hard to picture someone in the Johnson family in college. So I had incredibly supportive parents, and I went to a high school that definitely prepared me for college, but I had no clue on how to enter the system, navigate the system, and make that leap into college. And I was really nervous about being able to afford it. I knew my parents wouldn't be able to afford to help me go, so I was nervous about how I was going to pay for it.
I understand you were just at the White House, too. You've got to tell us about your visit to Washington.
Oh, it was phenomenal. I'm actually participating in a couple of task forces led by President Obama and First Lady Obama. It's really interesting how both the President, the First Lady, as well as the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, are all aligned around this agenda that low-income students need to have the opportunity to go to college. So last week, I got to participate in two White House events. One was around improving the field of school counseling. School counselors need to be better prepared and trained as college advisors, and we need to support school counselors so that they can play that role. And then the second event was really around the work that we've been doing in Michigan for the last 4 years, this idea of aligning community leaders across sectors around this agenda of helping more students go to college. So I met with 10 different communities throughout the country with the president of their university, the president of their community college, their superintendent of K-12, to get them to use data to continuously improve their college readiness rates, college enrollment rates, and college completion rates among their communities, young people. So I met with people from Riverside, California, Albany, New York, Minneapolis, cities all across the country.
Are you under the impression that nationwide there are other states that are program rich and systems poor?
I'm convinced of it. And I think that I know of it because I get calls from other states all the time asking how to replicate what we've done in Michigan in their states. I think that what will actually move the needle. Right now, about 60% of Michigan students go to college after high school. If we want to meaningfully increase that rate, we're going to need to accelerate our pace, and business as usual won't do that. So by increasing the effectiveness and the efficiencies and alignment around various college access programs and efforts, and to really mobilize those assets is what's going to really lead us to social change.
Do you have specific goals, specific targets, maybe quantifiable mm-hmm. targets at the Michigan College Access Network?
Yeah, our North Star goal is 60% by 2025. 60% of young people, 25 to 34, with a college degree or post-secondary credential by the year 2025. The reason 60% was chosen is really because it aligns with what we think our labor market projections are going to be. Some very smart labor economists have indicated that in the relatively short term, in the next 10 years or so, 62% of all jobs in Michigan will require post-secondary education. Not just 62% of new jobs, 60% of all jobs will require post-secondary education.
Where does your funding come from?
So it primarily comes from two sources. Under Governor Snyder's leadership, we were able to secure a $2 million state appropriation fund our efforts. And I match that philanthropically with foundations like the Kresge Foundation, which happens to be in our backyard in Troy, as well as a prominent national foundation called Lumina Foundation that's based in Indianapolis. Both have an agenda around higher education, and their grant-making portfolios are such. Most of the funding that we receive, we actually push out and re-grant to Michigan communities to support their efforts. We spark these cross-sector collaborations called local college access networks and invest in the strategies that we know will make a difference in those communities.
Do you have opportunities to volunteer at MCAN?
Yes. So one of a great volunteer opportunity happens in the first week of November. We host an initiative called the Michigan College Application Week, where we challenge high schools to help every single student complete at least one college application during the school day, during the school week. We partner with colleges to waive fees during that week, and we use it really as a rallying point for high schools to encourage their seniors to apply to college. And we're always looking for volunteers in those high schools during college application week. And like I said, it's the first week of November this year. So you can certainly contact us, and we'll hook you up with a local school where you can help students fill out applications.
And speaking of connectivity, how do they connect with you?
Our website is www.micollegeaccess.org, and my email information is right there on that page.
micollegeaccess.org. Brandi Johnson is the founder and executive director of the Michigan College Access Network. Many thanks for telling us about your organization today.
Thank you.
And good luck. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll talk with Rick Pluta about today's federal appeals court hearing on gay marriage in Michigan. We'll also talk with MSU's LGBT Resource Center about the $1 million donation they received recently and find out more about the work that they do. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of WKAR's Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery, to Aaron Young for engineering, and to Nicole Strobel for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Many thanks for joining us on Current State on WKAR.